dollar, 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 that's what I need.
Hey, hey.
Well, I need a dollar, 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 that's what I need.
Hey, hey.
Said I need a dollar, 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 that's what I need. And if I share with you my story, would you share your dollar with me?
11 afternoon now on WGN. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm John Williams. We are here weekdays all the way until 1 o'clock. Then Anna DeVlantis comes your way. And that'll be starting a little after the 1 o'clock edition of WGN Radio News. John DeGerian normally finds us here from MarketRebellion.com at this time. And there he is. John, welcome to the show. How are you today?
Oh, I'm feeling pretty good today, John. Thank you.
I'm glad to hear it. Let's talk a little bit about school closures. It's very interesting, isn't it, that not only have schools made the difficult decision, but then they had to sort of rejigger those decisions. We have more and more parents that have to stay at home with the kids that are staying home. And you've been looking at how that's impacting jobs. What are you talking about there?
Well, if you've got parents that have to stay home for the kids, that's going to be an issue, obviously, in terms of reopening the economy, because so many parents, essential, and I guess those of us who are non-essential, will have a hard time returning to work if indeed that means that the kids who are studying at home would be left alone all day. I'm not the first one, nor are you, to think of that, John, but that's been one of the severe impediments to the shutdowns, has been people basically just stuck with no alternatives. And so this is something that the candidates, I'm sure, will be talking about on the campaign trail. And a couple companies like Zoom have really been making hay while the sun shines, as they say, and doing a fabulous job taking advantage and providing a real service that people need because of it.
I wonder if you would describe that as maybe the double-edged sword of the unemployment supplement. That is, parents can't afford to stay home with their kids who have to stay home, but then the parents aren't looking for a job or going back to a job.
Right. That indeed. And we sort of got a little bit of a look into that, John, today from both Home Depot and Walmart. The numbers were very strong, in both cases better than expected, and yet the stocks have done extraordinarily well this year. So to see them give a little bit back, you know, 1% drops and so forth today, not uncommon, but it's what they had to say in their reports about the, in particular, Walmart, saying that the consumer definitely softened up in July. And we know that's when consumers were worried about perhaps some of the additional shutdowns that came and some of those jobs that were lost, as well as the potential, which became the reality, of course, that the end of the month might be their last check for a while from that enhanced unemployment benefit, that extra $600 that has now vanished. And whether or not Nancy Pelosi bringing the Democrat or the House back in session will be enough to turn the tide on that, we'll have to see.
I guess this would be anecdotal, but I wonder if some of the DIY projects people were doing when this all started have sort of lapsed. They don't need any more paint. They don't need any more caulk. They've already done the basement, you know? So maybe some of that spending is just going to dry up as a result.
And certainly that's a possibility, although I would say just my anecdotal evidence around the neighborhoods in Chicago are that that hasn't happened.
Yeah.
There's still plenty of places that need that other coat of paint. And certainly if you were asked my wife, John, she would tell you the same thing.
Yeah,
there are plenty of little projects around here.
Plead guilty to that, too. It's 12:14. Let's talk about student loans in a minute. John DeGerian from MarketRebellion.com continues to entertain us here. We'll visit with him a little bit about student loans, student forgiveness, and interest rates. Before we do that, though, let's go back into the newsroom. John DeGerian, MarketRebellion.com, is on a phone line. Let's talk a little bit, John, about what's happening with student loans, forgiveness, interest rates, that sort of thing. What are you reading there?
Well, of course, the vice presidential nominee under the Democratic front runner and now soon to be crowned, Joe Biden, is going to be talking a lot about student loans. Trump, of course, just I think a little over a week ago, basically said student loans would not have to be paid until 2021 as part of his way of getting letting people money and spend it as they would outside of repaying student loans. The average student loan, I guess, John, is about $400 a month. So if they have a respite of that until 2021, you know, that extra 5 months of $400 a month could be spent in the economy rather than some of those enhanced unemployment benefits that we talked about. So that was one of the way he addressed it. Kamala Harris has said that she would like to see forgiveness of $20,000 of student debt if indeed the student was to create a business and maintain that business for, I think it's 3 years is what she said, John. But you might be more up on that than I am. Yeah. So there's going to be a lot of discussion about this particular topic.
Yeah, it's and it's not the first time, although it's we've been talking about this sort of thing for a long time. I guess it's no coincidence that both parties are interested in forgiving these loans or extending the payments until after the election. I'm thinking of Terry Savage, who said they're going to throw money at you between now and November. And even if the stimulus or the unemployment supplement hasn't come through, this is another thing that both sides are very interested in. You know, and I guess like both of those other programs, John, I understand why that would be attractive to people, but I wonder what the long-term costs are to the economy and the rest of us if we just tell people who owe money, you don't have to pay it back anymore.
Right. And thus far, they have not said that. This is a pause, according to what the president did a week ago Friday, a pause in the repayments of these loans. They did not forgive them. But as you say, $1.6 trillion in student loans are out there. About one in seven is behind in their payments or has just stopped paying altogether. So this is a pretty big issue. And as you know, they have written it into law that these cannot be dismissed even in bankruptcy, student loans, that is, yeah, to basically encourage the lenders, which ultimately end up being banks. The government stands behind these, but the banks end up lending the money out there. And the banks had a pretty, I guess, fierce lobby to get that passed. I think it's been over 20 years now that that's been part of the student loan program, is that you cannot dismiss it in bankruptcy even. So that's a debt that follows you wherever you go, and it's pretty big. Like I say, $1.7 trillion. So when we're talking about trillions of dollars that have already been spent or pushed out towards all of us in America to support us during the shutdown, $1.7 trillion more would be a big deal.
There's also this story from Bloomberg today, and it's about if the federal government is late in getting you your income tax return back. So some of you, I guess what I'm hearing is, have not yet received your money back from the federal government, and if so, they're paying, what is it, 5% penalty, interest, the government is to you. Is that right, John?
That's right.
Is that new? Have they done that all along? Has that always been the policy?
I have not been familiar with that one, unfortunately. But that certainly seems like the interest rate on that is pretty high, given where the interest rates that we can all, that many of us can address are in the economy right now. It seems 5 is a little high, but I'll have to look into it, John. It would be something that would make investing more interesting for sure.
Well, nobody's, it's the only way you can get a guaranteed 5% is to have the federal government be late in getting you your income tax return. Taxpayers who took advantage of the extended July 15th tax deadline this year may see a little something extra from the IRS in their bank account or mailbox this week. The IRS is sending interest payments averaging $18 to 13.9 million taxpayers who were due a refund and had not received it by April 15th. So If you've got it, but you didn't get it by April 15th, then they're going to send you a separate check, it looks like, for however long it was they were delinquent. I'm surprised they can sharpen the pencils that tight, but evidently they can, and some of you are going to get an $18 check either in the mail or directly deposited into your account. Who knew?
Well, there's another $250 million because $13.5 million times 18 bucks is nearly a quarter of a billion dollars. So it's good to see how well they spend our money, John.
Well, I've always been of a mind that would they cash my check instantly. I mean, like,
boy,
if you ever thought the U.S. Postal Service didn't do a good job, try this. Send the IRS a check. They have it in about a half an hour. It's amazing. And suddenly, and that money is out of your account today. If they are late in getting me my money, I fill out the paperwork, send it in. When they owe me, it used to be weeks and weeks before you'd get your money. So I always thought, hey, how about the value of time on my side? Why don't you send me a little extra something for the inconvenience? And at least in this case, it sounds like they are. Any particular stocks that you're looking at or parts of the economy that have caught your eye today, John?
Well, this one sector, of course, we have Lowe's and Target due with earnings tomorrow, and we trade and own both of those two stocks in our portfolio. But I would say there's a stock called Workhorse, WKHS. Many of your listeners might not be very familiar with it, but they're basically a company that designs, manufactures, sells, and leases battery electric vehicles. So this is obviously a burgeoning bit of business for them to rent out, lease these vehicles, if you will. You'll see more and more of them on the roads. And Workhorse has been doing just gangbusters lately. They're spiking today, and we don't know exactly why, but we just figured we're going to follow right along with the unusual buying in there. So we bought that stock today for our customers.
John Najarian, MarketRebellion.com. Thanks for your time, John. We'll visit again. After WGN Radio News, we'll visit with Jeff Ostrowski, senior mortgage reporter at BankRate.com. Among the questions he'll answer is, buying a home worth it given how much you have to pay for some of these things these days? 12:33, this is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Jeff Ostrowski joins us, senior mortgage reporter at BankRate.com. Jeff, thanks for joining us again. I hope you're well today.
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
I want to read from BankRate.com. Here's two fascinating paragraphs. Nick Huber earns a sum well into six figures, but when he went house shopping in Boston, the entrepreneur felt like he was barely scraping by. He determined that even a cramped, dated house, one located in a neighborhood that required a grueling commute, would set him back $750,000 plus $12,000 a year in property taxes. Huber, a commercial real estate investor and a new father, had a heart-to-heart talk with his wife. They decided to move to Athens, Georgia, where they could buy a 2,700-square-foot home with a large yard for less than $300,000. I guess I'm not surprised to hear that, but whenever I do, I just shake my head. It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, and I liked that oral interpretation of my piece. Thank you.
Oh, yes. No charge.
But yeah, so we've had these really crazy gaps open up throughout the U.S. You know, you've got places where in like Boston where the median home price is in the range of $600,000. In San Francisco, now the median is $1.4 million, and that's not $1.4 million for a mansion. That's $1.4 million for the typical home. And then you've got places like Detroit and Cleveland and St. Louis and Cincinnati where you can buy a house for less than $200,000. And Chicago is an interesting case. It's a major city without big city home prices, and the median home price in Chicagoland is only $270,000.
I saw that the other day, and I thought, oh, well, lucky us. But I don't know that $270,000 gets you, you know, a terrific place in the city of Chicago. It depends on the neighborhood and what you're willing to put up with and what you want to have. But I wouldn't say the $270,000. I'll put it this way. $270,000 in the city of Chicago, you can buy a house for that or a condo. But that would go a lot further in the outlying areas. I guess it's that way with every big city.
Right, right. And that is a regional number, so that includes the suburbs as well. That's not just the city of Chicago. And you're right, you can, if you want a nice place close to the lake in the city, it's going to be, you know, maybe close to $1 million. But in Chicago, you just haven't seen these huge run-ups in prices that a lot of the coastal markets have seen.
But one of the things that the Bankrate piece looks into is say, okay, you move to Athens, Georgia, you move to Syracuse or Cincinnati, where home prices are much less, but the appreciation is not going up either. So while it kills you to get into Boston or some of these more expensive neighborhoods, Boston's maybe a bad example just because it's the epitome of this, but the problem is you're not getting a return on your investment over time in some of those more affordable cities and states. Is that true?
Yes, that's exactly true, and that's the real conundrum here. So, like, Detroit really stands out at the low end of the housing scale. You know, Detroit and Cleveland, home prices over the past 25 years haven't even kept pace with inflation. So you really would have been better off just renting in Detroit or Cleveland, even though the home prices have been so enticingly affordable. Yeah. And then on the other hand, in places like Seattle and Silicon Valley and San Francisco, home prices have quadrupled over the past generation. And so even though it seemed expensive 25 years ago to buy a house, if you bit the bullet and bought the house, you made a lot of money. And then the issue is, well, do you keep your house and stay in one of those expensive places, or do you sell it and move to Chicago or somewhere else where your housing dollar goes a lot farther?
How many of us have looked at a neighborhood that's appreciated over time and thought, why didn't we buy there? And the answer would have been, well, because it would have been painful for us to afford it there. But over time, 10 years later, 5 years later, 20 years later, wow, would that have been a good investment? Not so in some of these other neighborhoods. And I guess it brings to mind the idea of other people's money. If you can afford it, you almost don't care what it costs. Like, it's insane to spend $750,000 for a fixer-upper, but you don't care as long as you can afford the monthly payment somehow, because you know you're going to get a multiple of that back down the road. That's the theory, right?
Right, right, exactly. That's the theory, and the theory has been reality over the past 25 years.
Still, I wonder if that's still in play now. I mean, in the Chicago area, Jeff, some of these neighborhoods are very hot at some price points, and they're very flat in some other price points. And so how do you know which one is going to be the best investment down the road?
Right, right. Well, that's a tough call, and that really just comes down to neighborhood by neighborhood economics and the supply and demand. I mean, in terms of larger areas, cities, it's really supply and demand that drive the prices. So, you know, in the super expensive places like San Francisco and New York City, you've got geographic barriers, and then you've got very restrictive rules around new construction. And Chicago obviously has one geographic barrier to the east, but then there's no real barrier on suburban development. Chicagoland municipalities generally make it pretty easy to build. But I think in some of those markets where you're really seeing soaring prices, it's, you know, places near the lake in the city where there's just not a lot of land available and no real new supply of homes coming on. And so when you've got those situations or those conditions of demand and not much new supply, that's when you see the big spikes in prices.
Well, let's go back to that couple then that you talked about at the beginning of your story. Nick Huber makes a lot of money, but he doesn't want to and maybe can't afford a $750,000 fixer-upper and $12,000 a year in property taxes, which, by the way, does not sound onerous to some of us in the Chicago area. If your house is $750,000 or less, plenty of you are paying a lot more than $12,000 a year in property taxes. Either way, he moves to Georgia and buys a nicer house for $300,000. So did he make the best financial decision? How do you sort of summarize this?
Yeah, it's so hard to know. And I did ask him that question, and his response was, well, there's just no way for home prices in Boston to keep rising this quickly. It doesn't make sense. And he analyzed it in terms of what you could rent out a house for. So his thought was, well, these prices can't keep going up at the same pace that they have gone up. And so, you know, who knows if that's the correct analysis. You know, other people say, well, there's a lot of momentum in home prices, and the hot markets tend to stay hot and keep appreciating.
Yeah.
So it's hard to know. But, I mean, obviously buying your house is much more than just a financial decision.
Right.
It's also an emotional decision and a family decision. So there's it's not completely about the dollars and about how much money you're going to make when you sell.
And then you got to factor the COVID into any given real estate market and ask yourself, is that driving the prices or suppressing the prices? And maybe that will go away. It's just hard to know at this moment in time what's going to happen thereafter. Is there going to be a giant real estate correction, or will we get back on the same treadmill of every year every house goes up about 3%, which it sounds like a good investment these days?
Right.
So you don't. So, yeah, so what's the not right?
Well,
no, Jeff. That was a question, sir.
I thought it was a rhetorical question. Yeah. The COVID recession has been really strange. Like, you know, back in March, it seemed like we were going to see another housing correction. That home prices were going to probably flatten or fall. That people were going to hunker down. And really, the opposite has happened. There have been a few places where the housing market has just cratered. So, like New York City, for instance, or the city of San Francisco, but suburban areas, and then there's many metro areas around the country are seeing bidding wars. They're seeing prices rise, and so we have fewer houses selling now compared to a year ago. But we've got many fewer houses on the market. A lot of people decided, well, I don't want to put my house on the market now. I don't want people coming through and spreading germs. And so the supply and demand curve has just shifted. And so we have a shortage of homes. And especially in certain areas and in the more entry-level price ranges, we've got real, real shortages. And so I've talked to realtors who've seen bidding wars with it, 50 bids, 40 bids on the same house. And these aren't spectacular houses. They're pretty mundane houses.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we've had this temporary COVID blip in the supply and demand curve. And, yeah, I don't know what happens after that. I would say in the long run that nationally there's been a shortage or a shortfall of new construction. It doesn't seem that there's going to be a huge new supply of homes coming online anytime soon. So it seems like that 3% a year appreciation would be a good bet. But then, you know, all real estate is local. So it's been less in Chicago and much more in some some of the big coastal cities.
In Chicago,
with higher wages.
It's very price point centric too, as well as neighborhood centric, but as we've been talking with some of our other guests the last couple of weeks, if you're in the $300,000 neighborhood, you'll get multiple bids on your house. If you're a lot higher than that, then you'll get fewer. It might be tough. But to your point about how you wonder, okay, is the price going to go up again? You write about this Nick Huber guy in Boston, and he just can't imagine that the price will keep going up on those properties. But I think we've all watched that over our lifetimes. We'd say, this is a $150,000 house. There's no way that's ever going to be a $200,000 house. And then 10 years later it is, or 8 years later it is. And then it's a $300,000 house. That has happened over the years. So,
right.
So your story about this phenomenon and how it is actually playing out in certain cities is really interesting. It's at bankrate.com. It's nice to talk to you today, Jeff. Let's visit again. We appreciate your thoughts.
Okay, thanks for the time.
Yeah, Jeff Ostrowski is a senior mortgage reporter at Bankrate.com. It's 12:44. More business news now. This is Steve Bertrand.
Wind the clock. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, your daily roundup of Chicago area business news. The pandemic's been good for Grubhub in general, but it's been especially good for its college business. Crane says Grubhub signed up nearly 60 new colleges for the upcoming year. That's twice as many as it added last fall. Boeing is preparing to offer buyouts to employees for a second time this year as the plane maker extends its workforce cuts beyond the original 10% target. Blame the pandemic. Bloomberg says more details will be available for workers next week. And is this a sign of the future? A Chicago-based engineering firm is moving from a downtown office tower to a smaller loft building on the north side. KDM is moving to a loft building on North Elston. The Tribune says they want fewer office neighbors because of the pandemic. That's the Wintrust Business Minute. I'm Steve Bertrand.
All right, thank you, Steve Bertrand. Into Traffic Central. Mary, what do you see?
Some delays on the inbound side of the Kennedy from Montrose on in. It's about 24 minutes from O'Hare, 16 from the Edens, but outbound looks good, along with the Eisenhower and the Edens. The inbound side of the Stevenson, no complaints, and the Ryan also clear. Still have some police activity inbound Bishop Ford at Sibley, and inbound on 57, earlier accident at Halstead has been cleared. I-65 still running slow southbound near 109th, accident in the two left lanes. And in Crystal Lake, we still have this rollover Route 31 closed off at Three Oaks Road. Mary Vandeveld, WGN Traffic Central.
Back to you, Steve Bertrand.
Yeah, the Dow has paired off most of its losses from earlier in the day, still down 14 points. The NASDAQ up 73 and the S&P 500 up 10.
Orion Samuelson's got the agribusiness scene. Go, O.
Hey, the numbers in the grain market. September wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade down 10.5 cents a bushel. September corn is down 4.25 cents. And the September soybean contract trading down 2.25 cents. Livestock futures, Chicago Mercantile Exchange. The October lean hog contract is down $2 a hundredweight. The August live cattle contract is down 20 cents a hundredweight. And the August feeder cattle contract is trading higher. It's up 37 cents a hundredweight. The surprising story, I think, to a lot of producers and traders in the market is the continuing purchases by China. Chinese buyers struck deals to buy 195,000 tons of American corn today. China is grappling with spiking domestic prices, and China's demand for corn to feed animals increased as its pig herd has rebounded more quickly than expected from that deadly African swine fever first detected in the country 2 years ago. And chicken producers in China also pushing ahead with aggressive expansion plans. Chinese corn inventories have dwindled following years of government efforts to whittle down a previously massive stockpile. But larger imports from the United States could help Beijing fulfill that pledge to buy more U.S. farm products as part of a Phase 1 trade deal with Washington. Meanwhile, we continue to grapple with sizing up the loss of corn and soybeans in that windstorm of last week. The toll from that storm is continuing to mount, and now we add to that some dry weather in the Midwest Corn Belt that could impact the corn market and the corn production numbers as well. So until the grain is in the bin, it's not a final crop number. We'll continue to assess the loss to the nation's corn and soybean crops over the next couple of weeks. That's your money. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Now it's 12:52, Wintrust Business Lunch. Hope you're having a good day. Amy Guth joins us to talk more about the business scene. We'll start with retail and the Walmart results. What are you looking at there, Amy?
Yeah, so Walmart's Q2 report was really, really interesting because there was kind of two beats of it. The first of it looks like a very, very bright spot in that their second quarter results were way above estimates. E-commerce sales jumped 97%. So that's a really, really big number. You and I talked just yesterday about how retail overall was looking and e-commerce was factored in that. But here, you know, a moment where exactly what we've been talking about, customers were at home shopping online, doing most of their shopping online. Amazon and Walmart are in a lot of competition right now. So people are very curious to see, you know, what is Walmart doing as it's invested more and more in its e-commerce shop to try to compete with Amazon. One thing they are doing is rolling out something called Walmart Plus that is going to be a membership site to or a membership club to compete with Amazon Prime. And, you know, it's going to operate in much the same way because, again, very fierce competition between the two. But the other part of this, in that Q2 report that was mostly very sunny, talking about same-store sales even in person, up, you know, 9.3%, and this great news in the second quarter, they were also quick to say, hey, but a lot of this had to do with stimulus. So they also kind of threw a little bit of kind of a red flag to lawmakers of like, hey, if you want this good news to keep going, people have got to have money to spend. So it was, you know, the way it was kind of positioned in that call, that talking about how sales started to kind of normalized. Here's what they did in July. Here's what this happened. So they're kind of already saying, hey, it's not going to last forever if people don't feel like they have, you know, money to spend. There's still a lot of uncertainty. So I'll be very interested to watch, of course, what happens if there's a second round of stimulus and what that looks like, but also what retailers like Walmart and Amazon in that e-commerce battle, kind of how that plays out for them in the remaining months of the year.
I'm just wondering if when we go back to bricks and mortar, maybe they won't have the sort of e-commerce that they have now, but they'll just trade it for in-person shopping or how it's going to shake out. I guess that's their big question, huh?
Yeah, I think a lot of people have that question right now, John. I think, you know, a lot of different companies and different sectors of industry are saying, is it reasonable to expect that things will ever go back to exactly the way they were? Or are people going to adapt? I think, you know, the entertainment industry is having this conversation, as we've seen, you know, Mulan is going to Disney going, hey, no, we're going to put this right on Disney Plus and we're going to charge $30 for it. And that's where we're going to release that. So I think some people are going, is this how movies come out now? I think people in the hotel and event space are kind of going, well, we've just seen we could do a lot of things virtually. Will there be a hybrid model? I suspect that's what we will see in retail, because the retail industry was already really up against a lot of challenges pre-COVID with e-commerce, with Amazon, with Walmart, Target.com, and all of that. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, will the appetite be there quickly to go back to stores? And if so, how much of that, you know, how much of e-commerce will influence that? I think that'll be really interesting to see if indeed consumer behavior does change in a permanent way after this.
It's a supply chain scene for some of the bricks and mortar operations now, too. I think one of the reasons Target stores shelves are so bare, or they have so many fewer displays, is because they literally can't get the merchandise. And I'll just also offer this. I was at a bike store the other day getting my bicycle repaired, and I was amazed when I finally waited outside, and when I finally was allowed inside the store, how there were hardly any bicycles in the whole store. And I said to the guy, how's it going? He said, well, you know, the service is good, and what we can get, we sell instantly, but we just cannot get product to sell.
Yeah, I think a lot of different suppliers have kind of been feeling that. You know, we saw that very early in the grocery space and in products like toilet paper and bottled water. You know, we saw those kind of things really quickly. And it isn't that the product is not available. It's just a matter of logistics and how our supply chains work and all the many different layers that have to be functioning properly and humming along, but also how quickly they can be disrupted by any number of seemingly small things that quickly add up in the supply chain.
Amy, I've talked too much. We have exactly 60 seconds left. I know you've got a few stories to touch on. Which do you want to jump to here today?
Well, I think let's talk about Amazon. I think that is a really interesting one. You and I have talked about how much space Amazon has been snapping up. They're really looking at urban centers of the so-called last mile kind of solutions to have more products nearby so that when someone orders it, we can get it to their door even faster. So Amazon is set to fill another big hole in this distribution network, opening a big warehouse in Cicero. So we're talking about, so far, they have leased more than 14 million square feet in the Chicago area alone in a relatively short period of time. So I think we're going to see that reflected in our Amazon speeds. But we're also looking at tens of thousands of jobs created. And the mayor of Country Club Hills says that Amazon is also showing interest in a warehouse in that south suburb. So we're looking at even more Amazon space to come before the year is even out.
Bring it, Amazon. Bring it. Okay. Nice to talk to you today, Amy. Thanks for your help.
Thanks so much, John.
Amy Guth reporting on business for you and the news next on WGN.